been recording up to now. So those people listening to this talk in the future, please know that I've been talking about climbing up the mountain and our agenda, our hidden agenda. The hidden agenda of awakening is behind that, and it's maybe something that we've had as from our childhood. It's very human. It's very much in deep in the soul. And it's usually behind and not expressed. But nevertheless, there is a longing, which is really important. When we try and be a little clearer about this agenda called awakening, liberation, we find ourselves also a little bit stuck with concepts about it. Because we can only really look at something so beyond or big with the mind that we bring to this place. So with the mind that we bring to awakening, that's the way we look at it at this moment now. When we awakened mind, we will look at awakening differently. But from this place, the only place we can look at something called awakening. So it really depends where we are on the mountain, how we look at awakening. Or where we are in the mountain is how we look at the peak of the mountain. When we're at the peak, we'll look at it differently. So we tend to have concepts about awakening, and the main concept that we have is that it's an experience. It's just a better one, super one. And we build a lot of concepts around awakening. And there's so many stories, inspiring stories of the Buddha's awakening in one long night. We forget that it took him 7 years when he sort of hardly ate anything and he just about died and was a total wreck, and he couldn't even stand up because he was so weak and finished. After 7 years of super hard practice. So it's not just the night, and even the night of awakening, if you read the Buddhist text about his own night, you wouldn't want to go through a thing like that. With 10,000 soldiers attacking you with the arrows and imagined, all Mara, not real, but so we have these inspiring stories. But we tend to feel, well, look, it's not relevant to me because I'm sitting here struggling with my thoughts. So don't talk to me about awakening. But we still have behind us a little inspiration about it from the stories and from what we heard and from some intuition that there is a place to go there, a compass. We tend to create duality, heaven and earth. Earth is this mess. Earth is this stupid mind that keeps bugging me. Earth is, I'm sitting here, my back hurting, don't tell me about spirituality. But heaven is there. What is that? Heaven is beyond, heaven is above, heaven is the Mashiach, heaven is what I imagine the top of the mountain to be like. And so that's another thing that the mind does with this, to make kind of heaven and earth separation. A sort of mismatch. Two things that are... And we tend to use... to relate to awakening as a kind of measurement. How far are we up the mountain? And how close am I to experiences of other people that I heard about or read about? It tends to create measurement, success and failure. And this is very deep. One of the last qualities of mind that stays kind of right to the end of the journey of awakening is this one of measuring and comparing. And before reaching this sort of stage of arhant, which is kind of Buddhahood, one step below being a Buddha, but it's, shall we say, it's awakening. And the last step is this one of measuring, comparing, how far. Failure, doubt, can I do it, can I not do it? We have images of ourselves, not for me, just for them. I can't do it, I'm just an ordinary guy. It's good, all right, for the Buddhas and the Arhants that leave me alone. With all these voices of kind of measuring ourselves. And that's part of the natural relationship to something which is so mysterious, but yet so deep, and indeed is there with us in some way, but we can't catch it as a concept or as a thing. We sometimes make it, in the tradition, really, really big and beyond. And the tradition, especially the Buddhist tradition, a lot of it in Tibetan tradition, is super interest in many, many lifetimes, in rebirths, and it will only happen after many, many lifetimes, and karma, and we need to go through thousands of births before we can imagine it. And that's in the tradition. And there's the opposite, that it's really not very big. And awakening is just sort of being more happy. And there is that as well. It's making it very big, making it very small. And all of those are views about it, which are not really the thing itself, but the way that the some way up the mountain we look at the top. And so we can only look at it from the perspective of where we are. So a few words about awakening from place of tradition and place of experience. The word nirvana in Sanskrit, nibbana in Pali, it means putting out the fire, kibui esh. And there is an assumption there, and it relates very much to the way the Buddha taught the issue of ordinary life, the problems we have in ordinary life. He called it, we are burning. We are burning. We are on fire. And we keep feeding this fire. And this fire is our neediness and our desires and our aversions and our struggle and our busyness and our wanting to get better and wanting to be this and wanting not to be that and wanting to be safe and wanting to survive. And we're just constantly in this burning place, which in the way the Buddha described it is all coming through the senses. It's the senses tell us, I want, I don't want, it's good for me, it hurts me, it's pleasant, it's happy, it's unhappy. All the senses are all the time leading us and generating a lot of fire inside us. And nirvana is putting out that fire. And so it has an image of quietening everything down, of not feeding the fire. But fire is an element. So it's not, at least the traditional view is very clear, and the way nibbana is seen. It's not that we put out the fire so everything becomes neutral and dead. It's that fire is part of the universe. So we simply, the fire, we don't feed the fire here, burning, burning. It just goes out here and becomes part of the energy of the universe. So Nirvana has a quality of return to the universe, return to the source, return home to everything, rather than feeding this fire called this human being with the struggle and the intensity of life. And it's something there in Nirvana, which I think many, many teachers would not put it, and I'm one of them, by the way, would not put it in a place of many lifetimes, beyond, above. Something there is actually our base, is already our base. Something there is already our nature. That if we didn't have that in our base, we couldn't live. Life would be impossible without the grace, the chesed, you could say, of something that is not burning in us. And it's taking refuge in the Buddha, for example, is taking refuge in the Buddha within. It's not taking refuge in its real practice sense. It's not taking refuge in the Buddha statue in Thailand, because if I pray, or turning the wheels in the Tibetan prayer wheels, that if I turn the wheels 100,000 times, the mantras will do their work and I will be, well, sometime awakened. It's our base, but it's covered over. It's covered over. And it's important to know that this is a view that's very, very legitimate and supported, that Nirvana is in some deep way already part of us, and not an impossible future task. And when you try and describe it, Nirvana is kind of, what does that mean? What's the description of it as an experience? Experience is not an experience, but so what does the experience look like? What does the Buddha say about it in his experience? What is? So although it's beyond experience, still there is a person there that experiences drinking a cup of tea. It's not that the person who is gone to Nirvana never has to drink a cup of tea ever again and never experiences anything ever again. So what's the Buddha like when he drinks a cup of tea? And very much it's seen as something which is not necessarily beyond or ecstatic or unattainable. Not even really the image of the top of the mountain may not really be right. It's much more that the total mountain within the total landscape, all of that is the Nirvana. It's the images that work are the images like pre-existing reality that we don't see because we look over it. We don't see it because we look through it. We don't see it because we're looking there, we are burning, we want that. So the image, the space in this room is an image, is a kind of image that works. The space in the room, do we see it? The light in this room, do we see it? We don't see the light in this room. We see the light when it falls on a person or an object. So we see the object. We don't see the light itself. But it's there and makes everything possible. Without the light in this room, we'd see nothing. It would be total black. Without the space in the room, we couldn't exist. We couldn't get in the room. The space in the room allows us to have to be here. So it's something, even if we look at thought, for example, we would see a thought as a being a kind of object in the mind. But if we look at it with this perspective, space in the room, or light in the room, we ask, what is the light in the thought? And that's more a way of looking at object or looking at reality, looking at the cup of tea from that place. So it's clearly not something that can be easily grasped. You can't really grasp the space in the room, and you can't grasp the light. You want it because it's climbing the mountain, you want it, but you can't really grasp it. Famous Zen quote, enlightenment is an accident. So all we can do in our practice is be accident prone, more likely to have accidents. We can't grasp it, we can't get it, we can't measure it, we can't design it. So I'll read you from the Sutta Nipata, which is one of the earliest suttas, and it's very short, and because of that it's kind of sharp. The suttas there are good. So Kappa, one of the students of the Buddha, asked him, there are people stuck in the middle of the stream, samsara, and they experience the fear of the rush of the river of being and death, and it overwhelms them. So for their sakes, tell me where to find an island. Tell me where there is solid ground beyond the reach of all of this pain. Kappa, said the master, for the sake of those people stuck in the middle of the river of being, overwhelmed by death and difficulty, I will tell you where to find solid ground. There is an island which you cannot go beyond. It is a place of nothingness, a place of non-having and non-attachment. It is the total end of death, and this is why I call it Nibbana, the fire extinguishing. And there are people who, through mindfulness, have realized this and are completely cooled down, chilled, chill out, completely cooled, here and now. So there is a comment here which is, I just have to add, which Ajahn Sumedho added in this, this is what he wrote. And he said, just a comment about nothingness, the word nothingness. Again, we're in a place that we talked about yesterday of sounds like nothing, ending, empty, and so on. When, if you remember my talk yesterday, anatta isn't quite like that. It's just, it's unidentifiable. You can't find the thingness of things. It's not that there's nothing, nihilism, or it's just the thingness escapes you. You can't catch it. A bit like the space in the room. You know, you can't catch it. And so Ajahn Sumedho said, Nibbana is not a thing you can find. And as Ajahn Chah said, it's a place where you experience simply the reality of non-grasping. Non-grasping. So what about for us? What about hints of it? Ramazim, what are we looking for? What are we? How is it expressed in small doses? Kind of. Minun homeopathy shall nibbana. Homeopathic doses of nibbana. What's it like? So I would say, and a few of them have been mentioned here in the retreat already. Moments of simplicity, where nothing is missing. We're just here. We called it moments of rega'i chesed. Nothing is wrong and nothing is missing. And it's just simple being. Sense of silence or stillness. Not being disturbed. A sense of connectedness, where we feel belonging to what? To everything, the trees, the sky, the mosquitoes and the ants. We're not so different. We are them, they are us. Each other here, we are the same as each other. Belonging, connectedness. Longing itself, kmiha, this sense of longing, this sense of we really want to climb the mountain. There's something in us that's talking. It's maybe a deep memory that we want. They're driving us. Why are we doing this? Sitting here hour after hour after hour, cooking ourselves. It's something in us that knows that this is. There is a longing in us. We wouldn't have the longing if it wasn't something in us that knows. We wouldn't have it. We'd give up the beginning. We would say, "There's not, I don't know what you're talking about." The interesting place that we can experience the touch of non-grasping is at the end of grasping. So we may have a storm of anger or thoughts or struggle, and all of a sudden it ends, it's finished. And what opens instead? Very often there's a moment where it's just stopped. And the moment of silence. Like this famous Zen story of this a guy who goes to his teacher every day, knocks at the door, and gets instruction. And one day he came to the teacher and the door was shut. He knocked at the door was shut. Knocked at the door again. Door was shut. He didn't understand. So he knocked really loud. And the teacher opened the door and then slammed it straight in his face. And he got super angry. And at that moment, the teacher opened the door and said, "Now look where you are." And boom, it happened. So it's sometimes in the contrast between grasping, attachment, pain, difficulty, and non-pain, non-difficulty, in that movement, something opens up. And we can feel it in the absence. We can feel it in a small way at the end of a thought. Space opens up. The end of them in a feeling, an emotion, a need. in a very, very basic way, it's the end of hunger of a small baby that's feeding at the breast. There was hunger, disturbance, need, agitation, restless, burning, and then tsitsi, nibbana. It's there, that's another place that we can, in our ordinary life, we can touch. Another place would be, I was talking about it in the group today, a little bit the sense that we don't need to take this life, what we see, and especially this person, so seriously. There is a dreamlike nature. There is dreamlike. It goes very far, this view or this understanding. It goes very far. And there's a big tradition, as you know, Maya is illusion. Sorry. Happens to be your name, but I hope you'll forgive the Indians. Maya is illusion. What we think of as reality, it's a question. And is it the dream of now? Is it so different from the dream that we had last night? Just we're used to this one. So we say this is reality, just because we're used to it. But it's still something coming through the mind which we build a story out of and say this is reality. And a dream at night, we say this is non-reality. But who's to say? So there's a sense of a question around what is the reality, which is very, very, in one sense, really healthy. Because it helps us to get unstuck, unattached from beliefs and views and things are like that and I am like that and I believe this and they are like that and they are them and this is this and the whole thing. We were doing that all the time. So to have a sense, wait a minute, there is a fiction here. We need it, we need to function, still it's a fiction. That's another sense. And one more hint of the kind of experiences that point to it is just simply the bigness of things. It's the poem in my book, Erut, the beginning of the poem, which just says, our troubled mind still loves stars. Our troubled mind still loves stars. And that taste is also a kind of one of the homeopathic hints of nirvana. When we think about our practice, it's quite practical to have that sense at the back of where we're going. If we think of our relationship with thought, for example, we see the way thought loops around and it's pretty useless. Much of the time it's just looping around and it's pretty useless. Doesn't help that much. So, as Krishnamurti once said, if you see fully that thought is simply chasing its tail, tell it to stop. And sometimes it will. You just say, stop. And it will. Not always, but because it's, you just see that it's chasing its tail. It's just going round and round. And in thought, if we look at it carefully, we see what we do with it. We see we made it into a belief. We made it into reality. We build it into a kind of a story that we think is true. We make it as a fact. But of course it's like that. I know it. This is what I know. This is what I think. It's obviously like that. It can't be not like that. The mind says that. We believe in the thought as truth. But if we look at it more carefully, we already can see that the thought is weaving illusion. It's just telling us what we want it to tell us, what we used to. It's repeating the voices of the muskamot. We are attached to these thoughts and we call them truth, we call them our story. So we can already see, you know, and also what some of the suggestions here in the retreat. Can we see the sky behind the clouds? What is it that the awareness, the way awareness is looking at thought, meaning non-form looking at form, pure awareness looking at mind, journey, there's a journey there, and the journey is towards freedom, towards nirvana, towards cooling down, towards joining the world instead of being locked in the thought. One image that we can think of is the screen on which a movie is projected. So that there's a movie and it's projected onto the screen. It's a well-known image, but it's quite a nice one. The consciousness is the screen on which stories are projected. But you need a screen, otherwise you don't have any story. So it's like the sky on which the clouds pass by, or like the white paper on which writing is written. There is a sense of consciousness behind that. We can touch that. We can touch places without form. We can touch places that are more endless. We can touch places that are behind, like this space in the room. One of the quotes that I like from, again, Sutta Nipata, the Buddha said, "In every direction there are things you know and recognize." That's the content, thoughts. That's the mind, usual mind. They're above, they're below, they're around, they're outside, they're within. Leave them. easy to say, huh? Leave them. Do not look to them for real rest or relief. Do not let consciousness stay on the products of existence and on things that come and go. So it's quite interesting. He's talking about the content, thought, for example, as product, as mutsar, as a form coming out of emptiness or coming out of a product of consciousness. Like consciousness is endless and it gives birth to products, to forms. See how letting go of the world is peace. There is nothing that you need to hold on to, and there is nothing that you need to push away. Sensations that are felt from the inside or from the outside no longer fascinate us. And this brings the whole flow to an end. We keep meeting places of attachment and undoing them. There's one thing that all Buddhists will agree on, never mind which school or which country or which teacher, that they all would agree that the path is about non-grasping, non-clinging, non-hanging on. All Buddhists would agree with that, whether they come from Tibet or Sri Lanka. And so we can keep doing that. We meet stuff, we let go. We keep undoing the hindrances, the obstacles, the attachments, the forms that we think are true, that we believe in, especially patterns, mental patterns, tendencies, issues, beliefs, pains, history, reactivity. We just keep meeting, letting go, meeting, letting go, meeting, letting go, meeting, letting go. And it's not about becoming smaller when we do that, because sometimes we can think, well, if I let go of who I am, I'll become nothing. I'll just turn into a kind of a little kaza buba. Letting go is dropping stuff, but we forget that letting go lets in a bigger space that we didn't see because we were so full of the products of consciousness, the products of existence. They were in front of us. So we didn't see existence because we were only looking at the products of existence. So every bit of letting go invites a bigger space, invites us to be in a bigger place. So we should remember that, because otherwise we think letting go is, I shouldn't do it because it's kind of making me smaller. I let go pieces of myself and it doesn't feel right. Yeah, it can feel uncomfortable, and indeed we have to do it in the right way, and this is not the time to talk about it, but we shouldn't do it drastically, we shouldn't do it with aggression, we should do it naturally, etc., etc. But it's just worth remembering that letting go of stuff invites a bigger view, invites other things to come in, rather than just becoming smaller. Mind you, there is an Indian story that I like, and I heard it from an Indian boy in Tiruvannamalai. He said, it's probably his guru that told him, he said, spiritual practice is like ants that eat a piece of sugar. So we're all thinking, spiritual practice is having the sugar. But he said, no, it's the opposite. The ants are the spiritual practice and we are the sugar. And we disappear. So I want to sort of finish with a reflection that the word mindfulness, a translation of the word mindfulness, sati, is remembering. Remembering is a chrut. And it's indeed remembering to be present, to be with our life, and not forgetting and not switching off and not being an automatic pilot, tayas automati, and not being in some sort of a blank anesthesia, hardama kaze. But it's also remembering that there is our nature knows some deep way, knows freedom. It's remembering the freedom that we already know, because we cannot imagine nirvana if it didn't already exist. It cannot be there. And the Buddha says it again and again. It has to be part of us. Indeed, it's a part maybe very buried, very forgotten, and so on, but remembering also is there, is remembering some big place in our soul that we forgot. The third noble truth of the four noble truths of the Buddha is truth of awakening, non-attachment. Well, it's not, if it's a truth, it's got to be a truth. Not just true for the Buddha, and not true for everybody else. If it's a truth, it's got to be a truth. It's part of things. And so it has to be somewhere in the sense of being alive. However much we cover it. But as I say, very often we jump over it because it's very close. It's part of us, so we don't notice it. Like I was saying before, it's as if we are in our house, but we don't know we're at home because we're looking out of the window. And we forgot that we just don't remember that we're at home because we're looking out of the window. There's a way of that might be helpful to us to understand all of this a bit better, and it's also in a way to understand anatta, non-self, and that is that, as Ajahn Chah said, as Ajahn Sumedho said, as the Buddha said about no-thingness, there's a way of looking at what we cannot really know that it's simply living with what is unknowable or unfindable or undescribable, which we all do know what that is. We do know mystery. It create a huge defense against mystery and spend our entire life from birth, kita alaf, kita bet, kita gimu, kita dal, pushing away mystery and filling ourselves with knowledge. But there is a way that we can understand both no-thingness, nothingness, and non-attachment, and nirvana, as the unfindability, that we cannot find, just like we cannot find the light in this room, we cannot catch it. So it's something that's quite important, that if we can live a little bit with mystery, we are living in a much richer life without the need to define and describe and know everything. I will finish with a sutta, a text from the Sutta Nipata about this. So a student came to the Buddha and said, how do you recognize an enlightened person? I'll leave a small half a minute space for you to answer the question in yourselves. Ask yourselves that question. How would you recognize an enlightened person? So the Buddha answered, and it's just beautiful. He said, you recognize them because you can't find them. So the student said, well, what do you mean by that? I just don't understand. Clearly it's not easy to understand. So the Buddha said, you can't find an enlightened person because they don't obey the normal rules of definition, description, and construction. You can't find them because they're in a place that is not describable. So therefore, there's no language that can describe where they're at. And therefore, you could say an enlightened person is undefinable. And I think that, to me, it's really lovely. And it is not against ordinary life. The same unfindable person will be digging the garden and cooking in the kitchen, and just like all the enlightened folks since the beginning of time, they're playing with grandchildren and doing life. They're not gone somewhere else in some impossible celestial kingdom beyond the beyond. So that this maybe help you to have another view of what is Nibbana, what is awakening. Thank you. So let's take a moment.